Again, thanks to Rich for bringing us all together. I'm so excited about this symposium because it gives me a chance to catch up on some things that there's so many people working on these crops that none of us can possibly stay attuned to all of it. I'm going to talk about the involvement of a whole team of people. You had a slide from Suzanne Nelson from who managed the Native Seed Search Collection for 25 years, and Wendy Hodgson is here, who's worked on some of these things at the Desert Museum. But there's this very interesting thing that Tucson's just become a designated the first city of gastronomy or food cultures in the United States, and we're really combining a lot of information with archaeologists and anthropologists and agricultural historians to see how our crop diversity has changed through time. And as Rich suggested in one of his slides, there's been a renewal of interest and a renewal not only in protecting and utilizing so-called heirlooms, but doing some participatory breeding with some of these things, in addition to domesticating new crops, something that people in Tucson and Riverside have been involved in for about 40 years. And so I'm going to try to talk about how the utilization and interest in desert-adapted foods has helped drive some of these efforts over the last 40 years. This interest in native crop diversity not only has resulted in this recent UNESCO designation. I just came in from Tucson, where we had a three-day conference on food and water in arid lands that included about 350 people and people from about a dozen tribes and other arid regions around the world. But we also have the greatest number of heirloom or heritage foods on the Slow Food International Foundation's Ark of Taste. And this is one indicator that restaurateurs and community-supported agriculture projects and the farmers market vendors are also maintaining or even driving interest in some of these things. And we have over 120 artisanal products from about 40 vendors or micro-enterprises in Tucson that are getting these things into restaurants and other parts of the economy every day of the year now. So that's a big slide and a couple typos. I've had a concussion the last couple of years, so if you see some flipped letters or words, that's because my reading capabilities on for slides are down. But the point here is that that there's also renewed interest in the things from any arid land of being evaluated in other arid lands. So the kepari beans that Giles and other people worked at have not just been evaluated and utilized in Malawi, but several other African countries. And there's some very interesting things going on. I really learn a lot from Rich's colleague, Paul Bosland, who's doing what is sort of the analogy of resurrection ecology, of taking old seeds and seeing how they've changed through time, of taking earlier releases of varieties like the New Mex 64, and going back and seeing in taste tests and other quality evaluations whether what is being grown now is different from what was originally released. And in this case, Paul found that people really like the original release earlier in terms of the meat thickness of the chili and all of that. So he's going back to earlier releases and doing some more breeding on those and releasing them. So there's a lot of interesting things that remind us that these so-called heirlooms or land races, whatever term you want to use for them, are not museum pieces, but dynamic, both because of farmer selection and plant breeder selection. I want to talk specifically about this interest that number of people in this room were involved in about 1976 to 1980 that was in part driven by Noel Viepmeyer and the National Research Council's interest in new crops in different parts of the world. About a dozen books came out, Andean crops, desert crops, etc. And I think both the gang that Giles worked with at Riverside, University of Arizona, the Texas universities, were really intent on looking at what suite of new crops we could take from plants that had long been utilized in the Southwest, but had never been fully domesticated or domesticated at all. So because other people are talking about the cultigens that are have been fully crops for thousands of years, I'm going to focus on those. This came out of this interest in genetic vulnerability in the 70s and homogenization of the diet and agriculture. And those studies continue today. Colin Corey, a former student of mine, has shown that we're still facing dietary homogeneity around the world. So the diets eaten in China, Chad, Afghanistan, Australia, Arizona are more alike than ever before. That trend has continued despite all the effort to rediversify our food system. And yet the hidden story is that there's been this grassroots participation in what I call conservation you can taste that substantially rediversified the crop production in every region of the country, but especially in the Southwest, and that since 1985 we've seen about a fourfold increase in the number of fruit, nut, vegetable, and grain varieties being shared through nursery catalogs and seed catalogs in the U.S. and Canada, and grown according to localharvest.org, where farmers self-identify all the varieties that they have, probably 50 to 100 different farmers for each of these crops are making their livelihoods off these things. So since 1988, we've seen the number of food plant and animal varieties in our U.S. food system rise from 5,000 to over 22,000, 640 species in our food system grown in the United States every year, which is fantastic, I think. So why then would we want to domesticate new crops? And this is going to be hard to see for those of you in the back room, but I'll quickly summarize it. Because some have adaptations to salinity, to heat, or to alkaline soils, other things that we still don't see as much in the domesticated crop germplasms. So in the 1976, 40 years ago, Richard Felger and I had several papers together trying to look at candidate species in about eight life forms, desert-adapted trees like mesquite, cacti, succulents like agaves, quick-growing herbaceous annuals, herbaceous perennials, and halophytes, if I didn't say them. And seven out of the eight of those candidate species, some wild, some semi-cultivated or domesticated, like some of the prickly pears, are now in Arizona and New Mexico restaurants, farmers markets, and gift shops every day of the year. And people are now going on to plant whole plantations of mesquite with sweet-tasting pods and map populations with certain attributes or traits that they want to bring into cultivation. And people like Peter Felker have worked on this in Texas, as well as Richard Felger beginning to work or continuing to work on these now that he's in New Mexico. So we're seeing them both being farmed and being offered as food, and there's been as much nutritional and culinary work done on them as anything else. This is just an example of things going on all over the country, of course. And so we have people that are seeing these heirlooms or land races that are adapted to particular places as points of departure for disease, that they're adding disease and pest resistance or doing precision breeding on nutritional factors, flavor, color, and texture. And they're really doing some fantastic work. The Open Source Seed Alliance is an example of that. Over 34 breeders involved in about 38 different projects going on like this in the United States. And we see consumers willing to shift their diets. We always used to say, well, we're interested in the crops because of the adaptations, but who's going to eat these things? And it's almost a flip that consumers are saying, we want to try new tastes, flavors, textures, and the restaurateurs are helping guide us into the utilization of these things. Some, such as mesquite pods, are now available in tortillas, energy bars, and beverages, and target audiences to people that suffer from adult onset diabetes. So one woman that I met about 2003 on a street corner selling flour tortillas now makes a minimum of 350 dozen mesquite tortillas every week and sells them mostly to diabetes clinics and farmers markets in neighborhoods where there's a high level of diabetes. Prickly pear, of course, you all know, but its water use efficiency and the variety of new uses continues to astound me. Paul Boslin has also worked not just with the domesticated chili shown in the picture, but the wild chiltepines, as have people in this room. And when they're up to $90 a pound or a kilo for fruit, you know, there's obviously interest in now. A number of Mexican farmers are growing and selecting them for characters such as fascicled fruit clusters that can all be harvested at once. So there's some really interesting selection work being done there. And it's not just about the crops themselves, but redesigning food supply chains for these things. And we see those happening with chias and grain amaranths and quinoa pods and a number of other things. Breeders and bakers are expressing to us that they've made observations about gene-environment interactions, that when we grew the same breeding line of white Sonora wheat, the oldest wheat in the Southwest, the Skagit Valley in Washington and down in Tucson, those are, I mean, the shapes are obviously different, but the color, the texture, the amount of sugar in the same line grown in two environments was incredible. So much more caramelization in the ones grown in Western Washington, and so the bakers are coming back to us and saying, "What's all this variation about? How should we deal with it?" This is really just a way to encourage those of you who are graduate students or have graduate students to pay more attention to these crops, get involved in participatory plant breeding with farmers and chefs. We now see farmer-chef collaboratives that are doing great work with plant breeders, and try to fit these into different agro-habitats that we hadn't paid much attention to breeding for, like agroforestry systems in desert areas. And so my final interest is that we really need to screen and evaluate these things, not only for monocultural field crop production, but the many kinds of multiple cropping that reduce drought and heat impacts on crops, growing annuals under partial shade of perennial trees or alley cropping between them, and then do the work with not only the farmers, but the chefs in collaborating on breeding and selecting varieties of these crops to different agroecological niches. Thank you.
We do have time for questions.
Oh, I didn't back
out, and then I'm sure we'll be recording.
Good.
And if you repeat the questions.
Okay. I'll repeat the questions, but they'll have to be multi-choice questions. Yeah, Lee.
Yeah, you said that you suggested 8 crops 40 years ago, 7 of them were adapted. Which one didn't make it?
Oh, the interesting one that didn't make it was actually because of the death of a really talented guy, Nick Jensen, and his wife, Susanna Bohorkas Jensen, that worked on both sides of the border on a halophyte distichless palmeri. And so he made dozens of collections and was growing them and actually got them into the marketplace, both in southern Arizona and in Sonora. He had a tragic death. His wife, Susanna, died, I think, within a year. and it sort of was so devastating for people that it took another 10 or 15 years before Ed Glenn of the Environmental Research Lab at the University of Arizona and Richard Felger have begun to work on it again. And so it's clear that it was at least semi-domesticated. There's populations of it from the Colorado River Delta down about 150 kilometers along and wetlands along the Sea of Cortez. So it's a very large grained halophytic grass that I think we're going to see some new stuff. But it fell out of the market. It wasn't a failure in any other sense, but we lost the two people that championed it the most. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, Jerusalem artichokes are in a number of evaluation projects from, I think, the Carolinas to Arkansas right now, and that's looking at both selected French varieties. It's one of those things like beans that when it went to Europe, it was selected for things that hadn't been bred or selected for in the United States and then came back to us. And there's all kinds of clones still out in the landscape that people are evaluating too. And other than the sunchoke, which, correct me if I'm wrong, that may be a hybrid, that's what I've been told, between two species, there still needs to be a lot of work with the Jerusalem artichoke genetic variation. And I would guess that we could find things that you could grow in a whole lot of some of those managed wetland environments in California with irrigation tailwater overflow and things like that. So I think that's quite possible.
We have done experiments with salinity.
Yeah.
It adapted quite well to salinity riverside, but I haven't seen anything.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, just think of all the places where we have tailwater from irrigation where it could fit in. But does anyone know, is sunchokes a tuberosa annuus cross? Is there a sunflower expert in the house? Yeah. Well, yeah, because I see it listed in catalogs as just tuberosis and then X. So, yeah. That's great. So most of these things are really just in the preliminary stages of intentional selection. And unfortunately, in most cases, I think people are getting, with agaves or prickly pear, you know, one clone and then spreading it all over hell and back. That's a geographic area in the middle of the Southwest, hell and back, yeah. But the point is that I think we haven't, I mean, Peter Felker has done an excellent job of screening both prickly pear and mesquite variation in Texas, but I remember this great thing Bill Bemis did years ago with buffalo gourd, where he improved a variety for carpel number, fruit size, total yield, sent that improved variety out to 15 field stations from Durango, Mexico, and Chihuahua to Southern California and Southern Colorado, and the local ecotype out-yielded his selection for yield traits at every single one of those places. That's humbling to me, but really exciting too. So that these things like buffalo gourd, which I thought was just a, you know, sort of our selected weed that was probably just, you know, run up highway sides and railroad lines all over and didn't have much genetic variation, actually does have a lot of genetic variation that again humbles us when we try to utilize some of these things for crop production. We're probably out of time, and we'll let other people have their chance. So thank you very much.